Devin and Morgana have been celebrating midlife love by getting married 100 times in 100 countries. They believe grown-up love gets better and more fun, especially for women. Everyone's smarter, wiser. Men are more relationship-ready. And if they're not, it's obvious. Forget anything you were told about being too old or too late for love and adventure. Instead, get fresh new tips on dating, relating, and travel to exotic destinations. And best of all, call in for personal guidance, creating crazy, sexy midlife love in your life.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Crazy Sexy Midlife Love. I am your co-host, Morgana Ray, and here's my husband, Devin.
And here I am another week with my lovely wife.
And we were noticing Devin's hair before we went live.
Like one of the Sopranos.
Yeah.
It's a little bit unfortunate. There's nothing we can do. The show goes on.
And you're still crazy, sexy, handsome. You're my soprano.
Yeah.
You're my bad boy.
Okay, we'll go with that. But I have my doubts.
So the topic of today's episode, and we have a fantastic guest coming up in a little while, Ariel Ford. Longtime friends, luminary. I'll tell you all about her. But the topic is turning your mate into your soulmate. I know we've talked a lot about finding the love of your life, and we've also talked a lot about making relationship work. So this falls more on the side of making the relationship work, kind of part of having crazy, sexy midlife love. Like, what makes it so great is we are grown up enough to learn how to be better partners and make it last. And things still come up.
Indeed, because we're human and we're different.
Yes. So I was thinking of asking you before we bring Ariel on, Devin. What,
as she says with a wry smile.
Yes. What moved me from someone to mate with to someone to soulmate with?
That's a great question. I mean, listen, I've told the story about the lion in South Africa many times. And I think that was sort of the realization. I believe that quite frequently we are the last to know. And so I think there's a certain thing where it's just like my actions needed to my brain needed to catch up with my actions. In other words, my behavior with you, around you, for you, was sort of like the indicator before I sort of could piece the puzzle together on my own. And so I don't know if that's answering the question, because you're giving me that look like, what? What are you talking about?
It's just so different than my process.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I speak with a lot of men. And, you know, one of the things that I humbly believe is clear is that, you know, if there was one truth I was to say that's like, here's the difference between men and women, I would say that women are naturally inclined to be more emotionally aware and in touch with their feelings, like that emotional IQ, than a regular guy. Like, I think a guy has to sort of like, he doesn't even know he's wrestling with the problem. He doesn't even know that he's thinking about the problem. It's not even on his radar of the problem. And not the problem, but of sort of like having those kinds of insights. And I think where it's so clear to women, when I speak to women, they seem to be much more like, oh, I knew it 4 months, or there was, you know, oh, when he, you know, when we were standing under the street lamp at such and such and such and such, then I knew. I think that happens for men. But I think there is sort of like, I think we need other little pushes, little devices, little things that happen little by little that allow us to kind of really get that thing. I mean, I think there was this moment for me, when I started getting jealous, like I was like, jealous was a moment. I think when, and I've talked about this before, like my mother was like, I think she's just guileless. I don't think she's up to anything. Like there was that moment. But that was, keep in mind, that was my mother's insight. That wasn't my insight. But once she had that insight, it was like all of a sudden it was like the little clicks in my brain were like, well, okay, so maybe she isn't just this person, this knucklehead. Well, I mean, you are a knucklehead, but you're my knucklehead. And so, I think we need to piece together the puzzle. And I mean, I think this is true for a great many people, but I think for me, I think most people have gone through their heartbreak and difficulties and their challenges and their upsets and all that other stuff. But all of a sudden you start getting a different series of messages. And so many people are still reveling in the baggage and the challenges of what their previous relationship brought them. But I think once you make the decision, and I think that's a powerful tool, is like once you like, okay, I've decided this is what's happening.
But before that, and this was, I think, critical in the dating process, was you had already decided you wanted a serious relationship, that it just like, chasing skirt and dating a bunch of women just seemed like more work than it was worth to you.
Right. But I say that with a smile on my face.
Yeah. What did I miss?
No, nothing. You didn't miss a thing.
Because I believed you.
About what?
When you said that you were looking for a serious relationship.
No, I absolutely was. I think at the end of the day, like I'm somebody who I think knew that I do better within a relationship. And I also kind of got this idea that, you know, love is a service. You know what I mean? Like it's about the partnership. I think I got that part. I didn't necessarily like the road that you need to traverse in order to do that. Because, you know, relationships are hard. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
Without question, I knew that I wanted to be in a relationship. I didn't know if I wanted to be married.
Well, I knew that I wanted to be married eventually because I had never been married before. So that was kind of my bucket list, but I wasn't willing to.
So it was a bucket list.
Yeah, that was kind of all there was left and happily married. But I didn't want to get married to just anybody because I could have been married several times prior. And I didn't know that I wanted to be married to you. I just thought you were cute and charming and I liked you. And you didn't, and you didn't have that giant expiration date above your head that everybody else had. Right. Like you talk about moments when you knew I was the one. My transition was way more gradual, so I couldn't really point to any single moment. But I can point to the moment with maybe every other guy I've ever dated when I knew they were not the right one. And I kept waiting for that with you. And every time one of your secrets would come out, instead of it scaring me off into the woods, like it might have somebody else, it made you a better fit for me.
Gotcha.
So it just, I noticed after about a year that I was just really happy. I felt really safe. I still didn't see the expiration date. I didn't feel any need or push that we had to get married at any particular time. I just kind of knew we were going to. And I made a decision that when you said yes, maybe in 4 or 5 years, or when you asked in maybe 4 or 5 years, I would say yes. And then you messed it all up by asking me like 6 months later when I thought I had so much more time.
Right. And messed you all up.
You just tried to ruin everything. Right. But you
totally
didn't.
Did. It was ha ha. It was very funny because I think you were like, I love you first. And you were like, you were abundantly in. And I was like, okay, so let's go that road. And you were like traumatized. What? I thought this would be more hideous. And So that was kind of entertaining.
So we had to be like married 13 times in sort of like ritual marriages before I finally had the courage to marry legally. We had to ease in.
Right. It was something ridiculous like that. That's correct.
Thank you for making it safe for me.
Well, you know, what else was I going to do? I think once you make the decision, you follow through on the decision. And then I think, well, you know, one day I'll have a Sopranos haircut. And then what's she going to do? She's all locked in.
Well, you tried to ruin the relationship with marriage. And then when that didn't destroy it, you suggested that we live together.
Horrible.
And that we go on trips and we get married 100 times. Like, you've tried everything to destroy this marriage. A haircut is nothing.
Right. But house cats are a problem. But that's a separate issue.
Oh, dear Lord.
Well,
yeah.
We know that the max limit of house cats for one family is...
We passed it a while ago. We have to rename the show Crazy, Sexy, Midlife Love, and Cats.
Right.
That will tip our ratings over the edge.
Yeah, that's the over the top. That is the over the moon number. Yeah, no, too many cats, but it's fine. I mean, this is the joy of the Crazy, Sexy, Midlife Love thing is that you get to have a certain measure of gratitude. You recognize that you've already gone through so much, so you might as well just enjoy yourself, you know. So cats,
and we're grown-ups,
house cats.
So we can have,
is that the problem?
The cats.
Yeah, we've gone.
We
through,
can paint our rooms wild colors without permission.
We went all this way,
yeah,
just to be traumatized by house cats.
Yes,
and so there we go.
There we go. Tonight's guest is my friend Ariel Ford. Now, most of you know her as this pioneer in personal development for, I think, 30 years now. She is the reason you've heard of Deepak Chopra. She is the sister of shadow work icon Debbie Ford, and she has been a trailblazer in love, both in her books and her classes and her retreats around the world and in her personal life with her husband, Brian. So I just wanted to bring her into Crazy, Sexy, Midlife Love and talk about love and talk about her love life and talk about her wisdom. And she quite literally wrote the book on today's topic, How to Turn Your Mate into Your Soulmate. So welcome, Ariel.
Thank you. It's so fun to be with you guys.
So let's start with the good stuff. How did you meet Brian?
Oh, gosh. The short version of the story is I woke up one morning at the age of 43 and I had this epiphany, which was basically, oh my God, I forgot to get married. So I decided to use every prayer process and ritual I had used to build my business to see if I could impact my love life. And it worked. It worked brilliantly. I wrote down 9 pages of things to do. I did them all. And I don't know how long it took till we actually met because I wasn't tracking it, but somewhere I would say in about a year, I manifested Brian, and he actually exceeded everything on my wish list. And 3 weeks after we met, we got engaged. And a year after that, we had 3 weddings, and we'll have our 23rd anniversary in June.
Wow. So, why were you ready at 43?
You know, I think I was so busy focused on my career that there really wasn't room for anybody else or anything else. I was having way too much fun. And the only time I actually ever thought about being with somebody happened every Saturday night around 11 o'clock. I'd be driving home from a screening or a gala or a party or something. And I'd suddenly realize I had nobody to talk to about it. And I'd make this promise to myself, starting Monday, I'm going to work on my love life. And then Monday would come and the week would take off and I'd go back to making 100 phone calls a day, smiling and dialing and getting all my clients on national TV. And then that one morning, some switch just flipped. And I was like, oh, I should do this. And it worked.
So what would you say to, like, all the people out there who say, oh, you can't wait, you know, you can't focus on your career first, you can't wait until it's too late and that kind of stuff. What would you say to them?
Oh, they're living in the dark ages. It's never too late, ever. You know, My mother-in-law met her second soulmate at the age of 80 on Match.com. I mean, right now, today on planet Earth, in spite of COVID, it's never, ever been easier to meet and marry a soulmate, ever. It's just so easy right now. And the only people who aren't having it happen are the ones who are trapped in their limiting beliefs of I'm too old, I'm too fat, I'm too damaged, all the good ones are taken, online dating doesn't work. You know, they have a million excuses. And those excuses are going to keep them alone and single probably for the rest of their lives. But for the ones that are brave and bold and really have a deep desire for connection, it's super easy.
So you mentioned something a second ago about manifesting your husband.
Yes.
So you took obviously a very proactive approach to sort of like making that happen. And I think people do things unconsciously. Can you say a little bit more about manifestation? For yes. Somebody who's like, manifestation, what does that mean?
Okay, so let's assume, Kevin, that you are working for some corporation. You're divorced. You got four kids to feed. You get fired. Now, there's a couple of things you could do. You could sit home watching ESPN all day with, you know, well, if it's meant to be for me to have a job, the job will knock on my door, which of course you would never do. You're not going to let your kids starve. Or you would get your resume together. You'd get online. You'd start networking. You'd call everybody you know. You'd go to LinkedIn. You'd go to all the apps, knowing and trusting that in a short amount of time, you're going to be putting food on the table, right? This is what people do. But when it comes to their love life, especially women, they like, oh, if it's meant to be, love will find me. I want it to happen organically. They want to have the cute meat like in the movies. And they wonder why they're alone. They're alone because just like they wouldn't let their kids starve, they're letting their heart starve.
I was in a conversation with a group of women recently, and I'm just, because you come from this place of being this powerful, successful businesswoman, yay you, I hear from a lot of women who talk about their money and their success intimidates men. What do you have to say? Did you encounter that when you were dating?
It's true that there are some beta men out there who will be intimidated by a smart, successful, well-to-do woman. But that's not your man. I mean, there are 7.4 billion people alive on the planet today. Half of them are single. You only need one. Trust me, there are plenty of men out there who love smart, successful, confident, well-to-do women. And that's what you're looking for. You've got one. I've got one. All my clients have them. You know, this is not an impossible thing. It's an excuse. Oh, I'm too powerful. Oh, I'm too smart. Or I'm going to intimidate them. It's like, yes, you will intimidate some of them, but not the one that's for you.
It's an excellent screening device. Devin and I were just talking about, like, how did you know that this person was your soulmate? What moved this person from, ooh, he's cute, to soulmate material?
Okay, so that's a very layered question. And so I had dreams before I met Brian that gave me clues about him. He actually saw my face in his dreams before we met. And prior to all of that, I had been talking to him in my mind every day for probably a year. So there was a lot of levels on which we were already connected on the unseen plane. So on the day that we met in the 3D world, there was a recognition. I knew, he knew, everybody in the room with us knew. Now, just because I had this overwhelming sensation, oh my God, he's my soulmate, I was not prepared to commit to him and spend a life with a stranger. I was 43 years old. I had a lot at stake. I wanted to really get to know somebody because, yes, it looked good, it smelled good, it tasted good, but was he really good? So that's why we got engaged very quickly. But I told him, I'm not taking vows for at least a year. I need to get to know you, your history, your family, and vice versa, and really make sure that we have a shared vision for the future. and that we can be together. Because so many people live out of this limited thinking of we each only get one big love in a lifetime. And that's just nonsense. There's more than enough romantic soulmates out there for everybody. In fact, my friend John Gray estimates that each of us has at least 200,000 potential soulmates out there.
Yeah, that's actually like a Kabbalistic idea that's come around for years, because at each level, or what a Kabbalist might say is that at each level of our development, there is an equivalent soulmate to carry you to that next spot. Maybe they're going to be there with you for a lifetime, but more often than not, you want to aspire to be more. And so there needs to be somebody there for you.
Right. And actually, you just triggered a thought, because so many people think that if you meet somebody and you say, you're my soulmate, and you marry them and you end up getting divorced, oh my God, they weren't my soulmate. And I totally disagree with that. I think somebody can totally be your soulmate and the relationship will come with an expiration date. And it doesn't mean they weren't your soulmate. It doesn't mean you can't still love them. It just means you're moving forward to the next phase of your life with a new soulmate.
Well, there is actually, again, going back to Kabbalistic interpretation, there's something called a get, which is a marriage dissolution.
Right.
And that's a mitzvah. In other words, a good thing is getting a divorce, because the idea is that you fulfilled the promise. You fulfilled the thing you were intended to do together.
God, so, you know a lot of interesting stuff. I'm Jewish, but I've never studied Kabbalah, but now it's sounding kind of interesting.
Yeah, no, it's you know, you just happen to bring the right subject up. But yeah, no, I think it's a fascinating thing. And I think it's also an important way to look at who it is that what your histories look like, as opposed to, oh, it's baggage with all the negative mindset that comes with baggage. Oh, I failed. It really is. No, these were successes. They just weren't intended to be successes that last for the next 80 years.
Right. And people get so judgy about it. You know, they beat themselves up and they have to make their ex-partner wrong. And it's really kind of sad, you know. You made me think of something else. I spend a lot of time in India, and the divorce rate in India is like 2%. You know, and why is that? Because arranged marriages are still the norm there. Even if you're from a wealthy family with a lot of modern things that you do. And there's a reason why arranged marriages work, because they're looking to make sure that you are on the same level. You know, you're coming in as strangers, but you have this similar family and cultural background with a, you know, a vision for the future that is usually in alignment. So there's a lot that goes into selecting a soulmate.
Well, and it isn't also moving. It isn't marriage based on passion. It's based on a future vision, compatibility, and then the love grows in the context of that relationship.
Right. And you know, I just was writing an article for a magazine today saying that I believe that the state of being in love is the socially acceptable form of insanity, because it's actually not love. It's nature's greatest drug high. Your brain is cascading waves of hormones of dopamine and oxytocin and adrenaline, and you feel so great. But really what it is nature's trick to get us to procreate. Because even though we are raised to believe that love is a feeling, the truth is love is a behavior. Mm. And yes, there are feelings to it. But you can hate your soulmate on a particular day and still love them and still behave in a loving way. So I think that's where there's a lot of confusion for people. I hear the line all the time, oh, I left him because I love him, but I'm no longer in love with him. Like, you know, the in love stage doesn't last for everybody ever. They've actually measured it in, there's a professor at Rutgers, I can't think of her name right now, who's actually studied the brains of in-love people, you know, and it's proven the longest that state usually lasts is 3 years. But by then you've grown into a deeper, more mature love that feels just as good, just not as wild and crazy.
You know, I remember a dear friend of mine a number of years ago said, you know, love is an action and that action is service. And so I believe it is about this sort of, you know, obviously things like commonality of belief and vision and all those other things. But a lot of it is that you keep making conscious choices to be in partnership.
Yes.
to maintain the relationship and recognize it's not merely just, oh, you give me butterflies today, and if you don't tomorrow, then I'm right. Somehow the love is lost. It really is much more about the decision-making that we have to maintain the value of the relationship.
It's a choice, it's a decision, it's an action, it's a way of being. And all of that needs to, you know, really come into your selection process. You know, because if you're just going for the heat, if you're just going for that hot chemistry, I'd put money down that in 6 months it'll be over, because the chemistry isn't reality. It's fun and it feels great. But, you know, I've done a lot of interviewing of soulmate couples, and a couple of things they have in common. They almost never know on the first meeting that they're soulmates. For most of the women, they had no sense of attraction until the fifth date. Right. And the chemistry level with the soulmate is not as high as it was with other people. But what it comes with is maturity and this trust level and compatibility and things that are important to having a long, happy marriage with somebody.
I didn't know I wanted to marry Devin right away, but he was definitely cute enough and nice enough and safe enough to see again. And then when he lied about why some stars are green and yellow when we went to the observatory on our second date, that's when I knew I wanted to sleep with him. That's when he got really cute.
Yeah, listen, if you have to lie, you know.
Well, listen, we all lie all the time. It's just, you know, what there's levels of lying. I mean, there's little white lies just to get through the day easier. And then there are Trump lies.
Well,
oh, this was just for fun.
No, Devin tells a story, and it's so outlandish and ridiculous and charming that I couldn't resist.
Listen, my husband told me he can actually move the stars in the sky. So,
well, how can you fight with that?
No, it's kind of irresistible, you know. Like,
I mean, there's evidence because they move.
They do move, and. We have this friend who's a very, very high enlightened being, kind of like, I can't think of the guy's name right now. But anyway, he said that this guy that we call Doc taught him how to move the stars. Now, he was trying to show me. I couldn't really see it, but I was totally enchanted that he wanted to move stars for me.
Aww. The premise of this show is that midlife love is better. So I thought you would be a great person to talk to that, especially I do want to get to the topic of how to make your mate your soulmate, but could you speak a little bit about why midlife love is better?
Well, I mean, the obvious reason to me is that I now have a better sense of who I am and what my needs are and what my boundaries are. And this awareness that I want to spend the rest of my life with somebody who is my best friend, my lover, my safe place to land, somebody who will put their sword in the ground for me, take a bullet. Whereas when I was 22, I was much more interested in what they looked like and what kind of car they drove. Right? Now it's like, even though my husband is very handsome, I was never drawn to him for his looks. I was just always completely entranced by his soul. He's just got the biggest heart. And I find him endlessly fascinating to talk to. And it's nice that he's tall and handsome. But when I was 22, that's what I would have gone for, as opposed to being 43, where it's like, wow, this guy has some real depth and some real emotional intelligence.
I think there's a certain measure of liberation that comes with that, with sort of like the middle age component of it. In other words, I've already had the love and loss with the, you know what I mean? With the perfect woman, so to speak, to discover that she wasn't that perfect and to discover that, well, I'm not that perfect either. And I think there was a certain, you know, sort of understanding that in my 40s was sort of like a real game changer, that it was like, oh, there's certain things I don't have to hold on so tightly. Yeah,
I know for me, the thing that I really still like the best is that I'm with somebody I can completely be myself with. You know, I put on makeup for you guys, but generally my hair is in a ponytail. I have no makeup on and I'm just all natural all the time. But it's just great to be with somebody who isn't looking and judging you. Did you lose weight? Did you gain weight? You know, when are you going to do something about that hair? You know, I can just be me. And as long as I'm a pretty cheerful, happy person anyway. But even on the days when I'm grumpy, he knows how to, you know, move me to a more optimistic place.
Mm. Yep. I understand that perfectly. And one of the big learning curves for me getting older was to notice that if I am not being myself on the first date, if I feel like I have to impress or be gay or whatever, probably not the right person. Like the first clue that there was something special about Devin was I didn't feel any, I thought he was cute, but I never felt any pressure to put on any show or impress him for 6 hours of conversation.
Right. Yeah, I think the mistake a lot of women over 40 make is they lead with their resume, you know, and that's just the stupidest thing to do. You know, men do not choose a woman to marry based on her resume or see her as an ATM machine. They're really looking to see, is this somebody who respects me and how do I feel around her? They want to be with somebody where they really feel like they're shining. They like to win. You know, so if you're being competitive and it's all about you and your successes, of course you want someone who's going to support your career, but you don't want to be leading with it.
What do you say to that?
No, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, I think the truth of the matter is the world out there is challenging, right? And you can't control that. What you can control is give yourself the best opportunity to find somebody who's actually on your team at home. And it's an important decision. And so part of the problem is, you know, from my own history is that when I've sort of led with that emotional response, I've failed a lot. And so as I've gotten older, it's been much more about sort of like, okay, well, how is this? Where am I fitting in this? And how is it working for me? And that was for us, I think, an easy thing. In other words, we immediately had maybe not the chemical kind of, you know, explosive volcanic thing, but what we had was a certain measure of ease and comfort.
That's what I'm saying. That's so much more important than the super hot chemistry.
Beyond, without question.
Yeah. And so I tell people, if you go out on a first date with somebody and that you're feeling that heat, that is not a good sign. Okay. That's, you know, that means some part of your reptilian brain is getting triggered for whatever your pattern is. And you're about to meet your pattern all over again. But this is not who you want to spend your life with.
So let's go to mate to soulmate, how to turn your mate to your soulmate. That, by the way, is the name of one of your many best-selling books and what we're focusing on today. So what is that about?
Well, this was the book I wish I would have read before I got married, because after we got married and we were living together, I quickly discovered that I had absolutely no partnership skills. The thing that I excelled at was being the boss. And being the boss with an alpha masculine male is not a good idea. I wanted to control everything. I was the queen of my domain. I was used to controlling everything and everybody. Everybody worked for me. And so I had no awareness that relationship is a team sport. Now, fortunately, Brian's a very patient man. He played two pro sports, basketball and baseball. So his whole life was athletics. And he would explain to me, no, actually, sometimes you got to pass the ball. I'm like, what's he talking about? But I realized that sports metaphors weren't really going to do it for me because I needed to understand this. So I decided to put myself on a path to become a student of love, to really understand what does it take to have a long, happy, satisfying marriage. I knew we were soulmates on every measurable level, but I didn't know if I could keep us together. You know, as willing as I was doing everything wrong. And I didn't know what to do right. So that's how I got to writing Turn Your Mate Into Your Soulmate. I did 200 hours of interviews with the world's leading love and marriage experts. And then I took everything I learned from them and I road tested it. And then the best of what I learned is in the book. So there's actually 16 steps to it. So it's, you know, how men think, how to talk to a man to get anything you want from him. You know, things never to say to a man. Do you know, like, one of the worst things you can say to your husband is, you know, I can't believe how bad I look. I can't believe my ass is sagging like this. If you start putting yourself down, he feels bad. Why does he feel bad? Because men like to win. And now you're showing up and he's losing because you're making it evident that something's wrong with you. So if you need to bitch and moan and complain about your body, do it to your girlfriends, but don't do it to your husband.
Well, I would think that if you love somebody, it's simply painful to see them being self-abusive like that.
Right. Yeah. No. So, you know, it's about loving yourself, being responsible for your own happiness. That's another myth people go into. Oh, when I find the right man, when I find the right woman, I'm going to be happy. And you're going to be exactly who you are once you get over the being in love stage. So, you know, make yourself happy first. And then when you find the right person, they become the icing on the cake.
So did your marriage, because you've been married a really long time, did your marriage hit a challenging point? And
we had lots of them. The very, very first one was one day I found myself like this. I don't know what I was ragging on him about. And I stopped. I stopped myself and I felt really embarrassed. And I said to him, I'm really sorry. And I said, unfortunately, this could happen again. I tend to be bossy and overbearing. But the next time I get like this, would you kindly, gently, and sweetly say to me, when did Sheila enter the room? Now, Sheila is my mother's name, and she's also very bossy and overbearing, but I love her to death. She's a wonderful person, but that's where I got that trait. And Brian just cracked up laughing. He totally got it. And he said, yes. And when I get too patronizing, you can call me Wayne. That was his father's name. So we found these ways to quickly go from, you know, potential World War III warfare into making fun of ourselves.
Beautiful.
And I think what's great about that is that you're not making it about the other person. In other words, we can be self-effacing much more easily than we can by shaking our finger at the person sitting across from us.
Right. And I just, you know, I needed to be reminded that, you know, maybe I shouldn't talk to anybody like that ever, and I don't anymore. But that was my natural go-to. You know, another thing that came up for us early on was the number one issue in almost all relationships, which is money. One person's a spender, one's a saver. Okay. Brian grew up in a very upper middle class home, country club lifestyle. His mother always bought him designer clothes. As soon as he got out of college, he made a lot of money. Money was never an issue. I grew up in a lower middle class home. My parents fought over money every single day. I'd come home from school, the water would be turned off, the car would be repossessed. There were fights about money all the time. And I decided early on that when I grew up, I was always going to have plenty of money. I was never going to be poor again. So now we get married. We're both in our 40s. We both have substantial incomes and resources. And what's shockingly different is how we spend money. I'm a saver. I'm very frugal. Brian's the life of the party. Buy drinks for everybody. We'll only buy the fine, you know, drink the finest wines. And, you know, we're out to dinner and he's picking up the check for everybody all the time. And I finally said to him one day, he said, what, you know, they invited us to dinner. Why are you always picking up the check? He said, well, I enjoy it. It gives me great pleasure to do that. And I'm thinking to myself, but it would be more fair if we split it. So finally, I realized I'd never told him the truth about my childhood. I'd never told anybody about what it was like to feel poor. Now, were we poor comparatively? No, I never didn't eat. I always had shoes. But I felt poor because it was never enough. So I told him the story and I said, listen, I said, we have to come up with a solution, because it's not that we can't afford the lifestyle you're leading. It's I'm not comfortable with it. What can we do? So what we came up with is we created three bank accounts. There was mine, there was his, and there was ours. We didn't police each other on the individual accounts. And on the joint account, the agreement was nobody spends $500 without consulting the other. And we didn't have shared credit cards for the first 16 years. That's how long it took me to finally realize that I was with somebody who was financially responsible. That's what was key for me. It wasn't who was making more money. It was I needed to trust that even if he had 100% control over all the money, he was financially responsible, which he is.
And in the meanwhile, I love the separation of money because it just removes the drama. It's what he spends is no longer your business and you don't have to worry about it because you know what you have.
Right. And the fun part was he had never shopped a sale in his life. So I taught him, you know, the pleasure of shopping sales, and I had never owned a designer anything in my life. So he'd come home from the mall and it's like, oh, I got these Zegna pants for, you know, 75% off at Saks, and I bought you this full price Armani jacket. And I was like, oh my God, you spent $2,000 on a blazer. And of course, then I was afraid to wear it. I still have it. I won't give it away, even though it doesn't fit and it's out of style. Just the fact that somebody spent $2,000 on a jacket, it was like the biggest waste of money on me.
It just makes me hear my father say, thou shalt not pay retail, the 13th commandment.
Yes, yes, I heard that one myself. But in terms of turning your mate into your soulmate, really the place to start from is, let's say, you know, let's make up a scenario. You've been together 8 years. You're starting to fight about a lot of different things. You've got one foot out the door thinking the grass is greener somewhere. Let me tell you about the grass being greener because there's some stats most people don't know. The first one is everybody knows 50% of first marriages end in divorce. Everybody knows that. What most people don't know is that 64% of second marriages and 71% of third marriages end in divorce. Now, why is that? You didn't marry the exact same person three times, but you were the exact same person in all three marriages, right? So marriage is a lot about, you know, I don't like to say compromise as much as coming up with creative solutions, like what we did with our money was a creative solution. So when you're at this breaking point, you know, in the relationship, and by breaking point, it has to be the usual stuff. If there's addiction or bad behavior or any kind of abuse, then go get professional counseling. You know, don't try to save that with what I'm about to tell you. But if it's just the usual stuff, start by writing them a love letter. Like, I want you to go back and remember all the reasons you fell in love in the first place, all the things you find wonderful and charming about them. Even if it takes a long time, write them the most beautiful gushing love letter ever, and then put it in some kind of beautiful I love you just because card, and put it somewhere where they're going to find it when you're not around. That's a good starting point, right? Then if your sex life's on the rocks and nothing's happened there, there's something that's going to fix it, but it's really scary. And here's what it is. You have to decide together to do something that you both find life-threatening. So it could be jumping out of an airplane, bungee jumping, white water river rafting, you know, level 7 rapids or whatever, a roller coaster, scary movies. But go and do something together where you're both going to be scared out of your minds. And then immediately after surviving that, go to a hotel and have sex. The reason for this is that when you have a shared experience of survival together, it kicks off all the hormones in your brain that had you fall in love in the first place. There's actually a psychological term for it, which I can't remember right now, but it really works. You know, conversely, you can also do this if you're single and dating and you really want somebody to fall for you. You can do this as well. Just know that you may not know them well enough to know if they have the capacity to be a good partner.
Yeah, I would not ever lead relationship selection through sex first.
Yeah. Well, so, maybe first. Yeah.
So you've been talking a lot about sort of mindset of people and how to change it. Is there sort of like a very first step, or is it all sort of like creative solutions to sort of like reframing ideas in your mind?
Yes. And the basic principle that I go by is something I call wabi-sabi love. And so wabi-sabi is this ancient Japanese aesthetic that honors all things old, worn, imperfect, and impermanent. And it seeks to find beauty and perfection in imperfection. So imagine that this is an ancient, priceless Ming vase, and there's a long, crooked crack down the vase. The Japanese would put the broken vase on a pedestal, and then they would shine a spotlight on the crack. So wabi-sabi love is about finding beauty and perfection in imperfection. And I'll tell you a story that totally illustrates this. And this is the story of my friends Jerry and Diane. He was a psychiatrist. She's a psychologist. He was 30 years older than her when they married 30 years ago. And when they got married, Diane discovered that Jerry had an addiction. Jerry was addicted to poppy seed bagels. And every single morning, Jerry would get up before Diane. He'd go in the kitchen. He'd slice his poppy seed bagel, and it would sprinkle dozens of little black seeds all over her white tile floor. And then later in the morning, because Jerry was older than her, she would get on her floor on her hands and knees with a wet paper towel, and she would wipe up all the little black seeds. Now, this went on for years, but one morning she was on the floor wiping up the seeds, and she was in a really grouchy mood. And she had this thought, and the thought was, I wonder what it would take to never have to do this again. And she realized that would mean Jerry was no longer with her, and she started to cry.
Mm.
And from that day on, every morning as she wiped up the seeds, her heart would fill with love because the seeds now meant that she had another day to spend with Jerry.
That's beautiful.
I'm tearing up. That is beautiful.
Yeah, and that's what wabi-sabi love is. She didn't say, Jerry, we've got to talk. Jerry, you've got to change. She never talked to Jerry about it. She just reframed it. She just decided to make up a new story because that's all we're doing all the time anyway. She made up a new story about what these seeds meant. And I want you to know that Jerry just died 3 weeks ago at the age of 95, 100% blind and still addicted to poppy seed bagels.
And she was grateful.
So grateful, yeah. I think she started eating the bagels too. But, you know, that's what we want to do. We want to see all the behaviors that we're judging, you know, like, Brian and I had this toothpaste issue. Okay, so I would go in the bathroom and I would see my tube of toothpaste like this. And I'm like, oh God, you know, he's crunched my toothpaste. And then I call him into the bathroom. It's like, honey, come here. Let me show you the proper way to get toothpaste out of a tube. You start at the bottom and then you go like this and then you roll it up. And then when it's all done, you throw it away. That's how you get toothpaste out of a tube. And he would roll his eyes and walk away and ignore me. I tried that a couple of times. Of course, it never worked. And I started thinking every time I'd see what he did to the toothpaste tube, I'd have really negative thoughts about him. I know it was stupid. I know it was petty, but it bothered me. And I started thinking, you know, like, what would be the wabi-sabi solution to the toothpaste? And I thought, well, maybe I'll get two tubes of toothpaste. They'll be his and hers. And then I realized just seeing his crinkled up tube of toothpaste would still bother me. So I got the tube out one day and I decided to talk to it. And I said, okay, toothpaste, what's good about you? I need to know what's good about you. And the toothpaste talked to me and said, thank God you married a man who brushes his teeth. That's all it took. Now, does he still do that? Yes. But he does brush his teeth several times a day and he still has all of his teeth. So I just made up a new story.
I think that love is the ability to just look at your partner with rose-colored glasses and find charm and look for charm. We actually have so much power over how we look at the person.
These are my
rose-colored glasses. There you go. They're beautiful.
Yes. Do you know there was a study done about rose-colored glasses?
No.
Yeah, at the University of Buffalo, there was a woman who studied couples who consciously choose to wear rose-colored glasses. And what they found was that these couples had longer, happier, more satisfying marriages. And the reason is, by wearing rose-colored glasses, they were always looking for what's right instead of looking for what's wrong.
I believe that. Devin makes it very easy for me to find what's right. You know, it's life is fun. His foibles are adorable to me. He says I can have all the cats in the world as long as he can have as many guitars as he wants.
That's my negotiation.
That's very reasonable.
So now we have too many cats and too many guitars.
Well, there's never too many guitars. What are you going to do?
I doubt there's ever too many cats.
It's one of.
I wish I could get that going. Right now we only have two cats, and I would very much like to have two cats and a puppy, but I'm losing that battle.
Ah, well, let me know if you like gingers.
Oh, I have a ginger.
Okay,
his name's Banana Spaceman. I'm now. Oh. He's so cute.
I keep intending to trap, rescue, and release, trap, neuter, and release, but I keep dropping the R at the end.
Yes. Yeah. You're so adorable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's see. Devin, do you have any more questions?
Well, no, I mean, we could do this for hours, but I think we're probably closing in on time. So in terms of your book that we've been sort of discussing a little bit around, is there one tool that's sort of like, oh, this is a great place to start?
Well, writing the love letter, I think, is a good place to start. And, you know, I would say my favorite poem is probably the thing to always remember. And this is something by Sam Keen. And Sam says, "We come to love not to find a perfect person, but to learn to love an imperfect person perfectly."
Oh, that's beautiful. That is perfect. So we will have a link to your book in our show notes. Everybody should go out and get the book, whether you are in a relationship or looking to get into a relationship.
If you just want to love better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really not that hard. It's just we were never trained. We don't know what to do. But there are ways, you know, men and women have different brains and we think differently and we respond differently. And if you know, like, especially men, if you understand how a man's mind works, you can get anything you want from him.
Easily.
Yeah.
Easily. It's not even a debate.
It's not hard.
No.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Crazy Sexy Midlife Love. Please sign up to join our free love family at crazysexymidlifelove.com. To get alerts to live shows, call in and ask questions, or just listen in. And ladies, don't forget to download Devin's free ebook, Women Are Smarter Than Men and Other Secrets Marriage-Minded Women Need to Know. Also available at crazysexymidlifelove.com.